Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, and this is On Point. In the news this week, American Airlines grounds its fleet of Boeing MD-80 jets, and passenger anger is sky high.
An absolute disaster. I understand there's a four-hour wait just to get to the ticket counter. Shoot me now.
In Texas, more than 400 children are taken by authorities from a polygamist ranch.
Texas is now dealing with staggering emotional, legal, and family issues in the biggest and most complicated child protection crisis in Lone Star history.
In Washington, General David Petraeus warns against troop withdrawals.
Progress made since last spring is fragile and reversible.
This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes behind these headlines. We've got a great group this morning to dive into all this week's news. Joining us now from Chicago is Steve Chapman, columnist at the Chicago Tribune and member of the editorial board. Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
From Washington, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Good to be with you.
And always joining us, as always, joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Jack, always good to talk to you.
Hi, Bob, Steve, and Richard.
Let's go around the table to start the program, if we could, and hear your top stories. And, Steve, let's start with you.
Oh, I think it would have to be the Petraeus testimony and basically saying that we've made progress, but not enough that we could actually reduce our numbers below what they were before the surge, which means that President Bush will probably leave office with more troops there than before. And, of course, there was the follow-up yesterday by President Bush, who said something that I think is going to be part of his legacy, what he said about General Petraeus. I've told him he'll have all the time he needs.
Okay. Richard Wolff, let's hear from you.
I'd agree. It's Petraeus and the really, I guess, the shocking realization, and maybe we shouldn't be shocked by anything in Iraq anymore, but the shocking realization that for all the happy talk about the surge being great and obviously real improvement on the ground, it's not good enough to deliver on troops coming home. Actually, I picked up on a different phrase from the president yesterday, which is the war is not endless. And I think that's one of those phrases to go up there with collateral damage and mission accomplished as a sort of an encapsulation of a situation that really has no end. Actually, when a president has to say the war is not endless, it means it pretty much is endless.
And Jack Beattie.
Well, I join my colleagues on the Petraeus hearing, but to me, I was struck by the way the hearing set up the next election. It's clear that with John McCain, the war will be endless. And the Democrats will withdraw, will begin some sort of withdrawal, although Obama the other day said it's going to take 2 years now because of the amount of troops that are going to be there. It's going to take 2 years to complete any sort of withdrawal. And thus far, this has really been Bush's war, a PBS documentary of a couple of weeks ago called Bush's War. But in November, it'll be the people's war. That is, voters will be able to choose. How long will this killing go on? And it will really, I think, force a kind of moment of civic conscience for many Americans. Do they really think that any potential gain to be got out of this venture can possibly balance the undoubted losses, which, by the way, we didn't hear much of from Petraeus in the hearing?
Let's hear right now a little bit from President Bush, who's talking about troop levels in Iraq. Speaking yesterday, after 2 days of testimony from General Petraeus, Bush said that he'd accepted the recommendations from the general and would reduce troop levels in Iraq.
The recommendation likely to receive the most attention is on troop levels. General Petraeus has reported that security conditions have improved enough to withdraw all five surge brigades by the end of July. That means that by July 31st, the number of U.S. combat brigades in Iraq will be down by 25% from last year.
Misspeak on my part. I said that the president said he would not reduce that he would reduce troop levels. Of course, he's not reducing troop levels. Steve Chapman, is Iraq likely to look at the end of the Bush term a lot like it looks now in the spring of 08?
I think so. We can hope it'll look this good. As you know, there has been a decline in attacks on American troops and attacks on Iraqi civilians, but it spiked up in March, and it's not clear that what looked like we'd accomplished with the surge is going to hold. And it's not likely that there's going to be a lot of political progress, which, of course, has been the sticking point and which was the object of the surge to begin with, to give the Iraqis the political space and the security to make the hard decisions to enable us to take our leave.
Richard Wolff, if Petraeus testified as he did, that progress is fragile and reversible, shouldn't we be asking then what really has been accomplished, even though before the violence broke out a few weeks ago, there was relative peace?
Sure. I mean, absolutely it's worth asking what has been accomplished, and the administration and the military commanders can point to some real accomplishments. I don't think we've ever really managed to get our head around what was responsible for those accomplishments, and clearly the tactical efforts of the additional troops, the new strategy, the forward operating strategy has been successful. But just as successful, a factor in the success has been the political maneuverings, realignments of the so-called Sunni awakening. And that has had a huge impact in terms of security as well. And in that sense, the surge points to the bigger strategic question, which is what else politically needs to happen to allow a withdrawal and an end game? Or is, in fact, the end game going to be what John McCain and President Bush have identified as a stable, prosperous, peaceful Iraq that is no threat to its neighbors and a strong ally against terrorism? I mean, there are different definitions of what an end game looks like, and knowing what's happened over the last year or so should help us figure that out.
Jack Beatty, the end game is certainly going to be left to the next president. If the next president is not John McCain, how difficult is the Bush administration making it for either Clinton or Obama, if one of those two Democrats is the next president, to back out of Iraq?
Well, I think we're going to have to see over the summer just how difficult. There's a long-term agreement that the Bush administration wants to work out with Iraq that by some accounts would effectively bind the next president in perpetuity to various security arrangements with Iraq. The Senate is demanding that this treaty come before them. The Bush administration says, no, it's going to be an executive agreement. So we'll have to see what happens there. But if that goes through as an executive agreement, that will be a fetter. The quantity, the amount of troops, of course, is a limitation. It takes longer to get them out. And the continuing lack of pressure on the government to make changes, that's going to create problems for the Democrats. In other words, the incentive system has been wrong there all along. No conditions, no threat of troop withdrawal to the Maliki government. Do whatever you want. And really, why was that? Because the object of the surge really was to get the Bush administration out the door without a big blow-up in Iraq.
Joan is with us from Pembroke, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan.
Hi there.
Go
How
ahead.
Are you today?
Good.
Thanks for having me on. I was listening to the hearings, and Ambassador Crocker just sort of retort to his continually saying that it's very hard and it's very complicated in Iraq. I felt it was a bit patronizing, but I also wanted to give sort of a very uncomplicated analogy that if you were in college and you were taking a course and your professor said to you, there will be a paper due, and the due date is whenever. You know, whenever the spirit moves you. Human nature being what it is, I think that we probably wouldn't work on that today, tomorrow, the next week, or even the next month. So I don't think there's any urgency for the Iraqi government to move forward with trying to find solutions. And the same with its neighbors, as one of the senators had also mentioned.
Richard Wolff, is this administration ever likely to put enough pressure on the Iraqi government to allow us to either slowly or rapidly get out?
No, it's not. And that's because it's a fragile situation. That relations with Prime Minister al-Maliki are not great. In fact, just look at the Basra operation where Maliki essentially froze out American officials and forces until he desperately needed them. So it's a very dysfunctional relationship, and really the goal of the administration is to salvage a reputation and a legacy by staying in Iraq and hoping that things will figure themselves out. I've got to say that, you know, putting pressure on Maliki probably isn't enough, that Iraq's problems are more deep than anything a well-functioning government with a fine military force, neither of which exists in Iraq, but they're too much for even a successful Maliki government to resolve. The questions, the challenges facing Iraq are bigger than that, and they're probably bigger, as we've seen over the last several years, than anything the United States and its allies could figure out.
Steve Chapman, mortar attacks again today in the supposedly secure Green Zone. Is it likely to be a long, hot, violent summer in Iraq, do you think?
I don't think we can tell at this point. It depends a lot on what Muqtada al-Sadr decides on whether to maintain the ceasefire or not. That's been a huge part of the apparent success of the surge, that the Mahdi army has sort of laid down its arms, or at least kept them in abeyance for the time being. If that breaks down, then it could be a very long, hot summer, and we just don't know. We're very much dependent on Muqtada al-Sadr.
I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Did General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker convince you we're on the right road in Iraq? Are you shaking your head over the polygamist compound in Texas? Are you standing at an airport in a line waiting for an American Airlines flight that's never going to get off the ground today? Thousands of passengers were stranded after American grounded its fleet of MD-80s, Boeing MD-80s. Here's one unhappy customer who may speak for many others.
I have meetings in Arizona this afternoon at 3 o'clock and not going to make it. Paid for a limo to get here. Is American going to reimburse me for all that trouble? I don't think so. I think Americans lost a customer today.
Probably many customers in the last few days. Our guests today are Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, Steve Chapman, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, Frontier Airlines files for bankruptcy protection today, but says it's going to keep flying. Are other airlines going to drop?
That is beyond my pay grade. I haven't. So I will. I'm sure that Richard does a lot of flying. Why don't we ask him?
I have no idea why there are so many airlines flying. When you consider the margins that they have, they operate on, the miserable logistics that they face, the cost of maintenance and the scandals we've seen there, and the downturn in the economy, the high price of fuel, I'm amazed that there are that many carriers out there right now. I can tell you from my experience there are a lot of unhappy passengers.
I wonder how badly this is going to hurt American heading into the summer tourist season. I have to imagine, as that flyer we just heard from said, that he's not coming back, and probably a lot of other people aren't coming back. Steve Chapman.
I don't think it's really likely to hurt American. I think the people are just as likely to blame the Federal Aviation Administration as American, and flights being pretty much at capacity. There's not a whole lot of other places to go for most passengers. It is, you know, I've always thought of the airline industry as probably the biggest charity in America. Since 2001, they've lost $27 billion. They're out there flying every day for reasons that are kind of a mystery to me, because it's proven just to be a perfect way to lose money. Warren Buffett said if there had been a capitalist president at Kitty Hawk when the Wright brothers made their first flight, he would have shot the plane down.
Does that mean you think maybe there'll be more consolidations in the industry?
Well, I think the problem right now, last year was actually a profitable year for the airline, and I think they were on track to do well this year until the price of fuel went so high. So a lot depends on what happens with that. Barring that, you know, I keep thinking you're going to get consolidations, and you keep getting airlines that go in and out of bankruptcy so they can keep operating. Nobody seems to want to get out except a few of the smaller carriers.
You know, for passengers, it's got to feel this week like buying an airline ticket. Is it evolving into the same kind of feeling when you buy a scratch lottery ticket? I might win. I might fly.
It sounds that way, that's for sure. You know, I'm sure there's lots to be said for airline deregulation, but I remember years ago when this was done, people warned, you know, this may get prices down at the margin, but it's going to result in all other sorts of distortions, and we're going to have and it seems to me that has happened. It may well be, you know, that airlines need to be, God help me for saying it, nationalized, that they're a part of sort of our necessary public service, and we need to look at them that way.
Melissa from Franklin, Massachusetts wants to talk about the airline industry. She's on the line at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, good day. I just can't help but notice that this is sort of something that's been coming a long time. The airline industry has always been a bizarre kind of way of doing business. It's the only industry where we allow them to change the terms of our deal, our contract, on the last minute. We pay, we buy a ticket, we presume we know where we're going and when we're leaving, and then they can just cancel the flight or move you or bump you, and we've always allowed it. In fact, sometimes people look for it. Ooh, I'll get bumped, I'll get a free ticket later. We've sort of contributed to this. I don't have to travel much for business. I don't have to travel at all for business, but I have many friends and family who do. And we've sort of created our own nightmare on some level by allowing this sort of warped idea of a consumer contract.
When was the last time you flew?
2 years.
And when is the next time you're likely to fly?
Well, with this economy having nothing to do with this situation, it's very unlikely in the near future. I really don't know. It would be for pleasure if we could afford a trip.
Have the events of this week made you less reluctant to, stand in that ever-growing line?
Well, it makes me think, with very limited vacation time and very limited resources, the idea of a vacation requires flying is less and less attractive all the time.
Melissa, thank you very much. Ben is on the line from Linden, Vermont. Ben, hello. What's on your mind this week?
Hi. Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the Tibet issue and the Olympics. What puzzled me was that the fact that there's been a lot of coverage of this idea that some people have, that the Olympics shouldn't be used as a protest against China's human rights issues. But on the other hand, it seems to me that the spirit of the Olympics was really based on a ceasefire between warring city-states, that's really what made the Olympics glorious, was that there was this actual, temporary at least, resolution of hostilities. And it seems to me that the IOC and China are really kind of blatantly ignoring that aspect. I just don't see how they folded that in, and I'm wondering why there's not kind of more criticism, discussion of that historical point of view.
Richard Wolff, you want to take that question?
Sure. Look, I'm a sports fan and someone who grew up watching Olympics in various countries, and so I feel very mixed about politics and sport coming together, because the Olympics is such a special event. On the other hand, the IOC awarded the Olympics to China partly as a political statement, the idea being that China was emerging as a power, as a more liberal economy, and taking its position on the world stage. So there was always going to be a political element to the staging of the Olympics in China. And I think if the Olympics does allow countries to take their position on the world stage, then actually this kind of pressure, this kind of attention is useful, not just because countries have to build new stadia and have better transport and clean up their streets, but because people are watching to see whether the host governments are responsible enough to be part of the community of nations. And China, the Chinese government, has so far failed in that test in Tibet. So the pressure can be useful, but up to a point. I hate seeing boycotts. I still think the Olympics are special.
I think the Chinese government at this point must be wondering why they wanted the Olympics. I mean, I think obviously at the outset, what they wanted to kind of bask in the glory of being the host nation, and what they didn't reckon with was that they were going to get a whole lot of unwanted scrutiny, and that's going to – I mean, it's already started and it's going to continue, and you may get some countries that are going to boycott. And you're certainly going to get some leaders who are not going to go to the opening ceremony because of what China has done on human rights, and particularly in Tibet.
President Bush has been asked to skip the opening ceremonies. What's the likelihood of that, Steve Chapman?
I think I'd say there's a reasonable chance that he won't. I think one of White House press spokesman said the other day that he has never promised to do that. Didn't say he wouldn't, but they didn't say he would.
Of course, all the focus this week has been the Olympic torch and the protests greeting the torch as it's been flown around the world. Here's a sample of what greeted the torch when it arrived in San Francisco on Wednesday. Protests in San Francisco this week. Has China and the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, already lost the battle? Does the torch this year not represent the hope, the light of the coming Summer Games, but rather this year it's representing a call to arms, a call to protest? Jack Beatty.
Well, it's gone that way. But, you know, the history of these games, and I think the torch reminds us. Someone told me last night that the torch as a symbol was started before the Nazi games of the 30s, and the Nazis suggested it to Avery Brundage, who was the impresario of the Olympics then, and he thought that was a dandy idea, and so it's stayed on ever since. And I think that reminds us of how how inextricably tied up this has been with nationalism, with triumphalism on the part of countries, with the worst sort of international politics. And of course, then you get the athletes who essentially are professional athletes training for it. I am not an Olympics fan, I have to say.
Thursday, IOC Chairman Jacques Rogge said the politically charged buildup to the Summer Games posed a crisis for the Olympic movement. Here he is.
If we let athletes or coaches or officials use the opening of the closing ceremony or the podium ceremony as a way to express these divides, this will be the end of the spirit of the Olympic Games.
So should the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, or Beijing throw in the towel when it comes to the torch and call a halt to the torch relays, which still have many weeks and many countries to go before the torch gets to Hong Kong on May 2nd? Richard Wolff?
Well, the problem with the torch isn't really the symbolism, it's the security issues. And you'd have the same symbolic moment for protest at the opening or closing ceremonies, and which are not sporting events. Look, the problem with the Olympics is that not only does politics intrude, but business, logistics, and so... At the heart of it, there's a constant need now with the modern games to remind people that this is about athletes at the peak of their abilities and talents competing against each other in hopefully fair circumstances. That's what needs to be remembered at the heart of all of this. But when it comes to the showmanship of the torch or the dancing and music around the opening ceremony, it's all peripheral. I mean, if it's not useful anymore, if it's become hijacked by a government or by protesters, then it's meaningless.
Jack Beatty.
I think that's probably right. What I don't understand, and maybe Richard or Steve can enlighten me, how come we couldn't have gotten more out of China with this leverage of these games? Why wasn't more done on Darfur? I mean, leave out Tibet, but why? Here was tremendous leverage on this regime, unexampled opportunity to get it to change its ways. And I don't see that anything's happened, according to Nick Kristof. In fact, the Chinese have been supplying warplanes to the Sudanese regime, which has been using them in Darfur. Why weren't we able to get more?
Steve Chapman, take a stab at Jack's question.
Well, of course, when the games were awarded to Beijing back in 2001, I don't think Sudan and Darfur were on anybody's radar. And, of course, it's not the United States government or the UN or any other political institution that that decides who gets the games. It's the International Olympic Committee. So, I don't think its priorities have ever been sort of political reform. And to the extent that the U.S. has any leverage, I suppose it's only in the threat of a boycott, which didn't work very well in 1980, and I doubt would affect the Chinese government's behavior now.
Richard Wolff, do you think all this will be forgotten by the opening ceremonies in Beijing on August 8th?
No, I don't. I think they'll continue. I mean, I don't think there's any real chance of getting the Chinese to change their policy on Tibet other than for some sort of photo op stage managed thing where the press has shown how great things are. This is still a fearful communist government that is terrified of upheaval, unrest, and the breakup of the country. So that no amount of pressure is really going to make a difference, but it's still worth trying. I mean, that's essentially the position of Barack Obama, who says, well, you shouldn't boycott the opening ceremony right now. You should try and say, do something on Darfur, open up Tibet, allow the press to travel around and see what's going on, and then we'll talk about it. But it is late in the game, and the IOC doesn't have a political agenda in that sense other than what I've already discussed, which is rewarding countries it feels deserves to step onto the world stage.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine protests on the medal stands in Beijing, such as we saw in Mexico City in 1968?
Well, sometimes when you talk to these, I've seen interviews with these athletes, and to say these people are apolitical, they're profoundly apolitical. So I don't know. I mean, perhaps some brave soul will say something, but I think these people live in a world of their athletic performance, and that defines life for them. And any wider moral ethical outlook about the behavior of nations, I don't know that I'd expect it.
Steve Chapman.
It's very hard to tell. All it takes is one or two athletes who have been subject to a lot of persuasion by advocates for Tibet or advocates on Darfur to say, this is your big chance on the world stage to send a message to the Chinese government. It certainly could happen.
Mike is on the line from Cambridge, wants to talk about the Olympics. Mike, hi.
Hi. If the general public wants to send a message to the Chinese government, perhaps the best thing to do is to, at the grassroots level, organize a boycott of Chinese-made products. That would send a very strong message to the Chinese government, I think. And that way, everybody can basically contribute to this as much as they can afford in terms of what they do. And governments do not have to decide over boycotting the Olympics or not. Everyone can basically voice their own criticism by just stopping their consumption of Chinese-made products.
Mike, thanks for your call. We're talking about an action-packed week in the news. Maybe politics in the next segment. What about the poll numbers coming out of Pennsylvania? Join us. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point. Here are some other stories making headlines this week. Is Katie Couric on the way out at CBS News?
I'm Katie Couric. Also tonight, stranded at the airport.
March Madness. It's Kansas over Memphis in overtime.
A Kansas comeback for the history books.
And the prophetic Bob Dylan receives a special Pulitzer Prize.
For the times they are a-changing.
We're talking this hour with Steve Chapman, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, and our own Jack Beatty. How's the world look to you this week? Let's turn now to the 2008 campaign with the Democrats, Senators Clinton and Obama, stumping in Pennsylvania this week ahead of the April 22nd primary, trying to dig up every vote they could find. High-profile endorsements are also important at this point in the race. Thursday, on ABC's Good Morning America, retired General Colin Powell was asked who's getting his vote.
I'm looking at all three candidates. I know them all very, very well. I consider myself a friend of each and every one of them. And I have not decided who I will vote for yet.
Colin Powell speaking on ABC this week. Jack Beatty, are the results in Pennsylvania, when they come on the night of April 22nd, going to change this race much?
Well, it would depend upon the margin, Hillary's margin of victory. I assume she's going to win there. But if it's a very small win, it may really affect expectations about her calamitously. It may, and that may be reflected in a shortfall in funding. But, you know, this week we really found out what this election should be about. A census report came out. David Leonhardt wrote about it in the New York Times. They pointed out that we'd just been through the first recovery from 2000 to 2007, in which the median American family lost money. That has never happened before. It was $61,000 in 2000, and it was $60,500 last year. And, of course, now we're going into a recession when that income will come down even more. The pessimism among middle-class Americans is profound, according to a Pew poll, and this is why. Somehow, prosperity has become uncoupled from the growth of the economy. Oh, that is to say, prosperity for the middle class. And we say, why? You know, why has this happened? Well, of course, this is the first expansion when the private sector workforce has been below 10% enrollment. It's the first expansion under the aegis of the China price, which is after the Clinton trade deal of 1998, the essentially the low price of China goods is also a low price of Chinese labor, forcing our wages down. And it's the first post-Clinton capital gains tax cut and Bush post-Bush tax cut recovery, which, of course, has gone given benefits differentially to the people at the top. So this is a huge issue, and the survival of the American middle class is really the issue at stake, and I hope it gets attention from the candidates.
Well, Jack, how do you think what you're talking about, the economy, the future of the middle class, the future of America really is factoring into the conversation that superdelegates are having with themselves and with one another as they decide which way they're going to go?
Well, I think they have to figure out, you know, which of the candidates can make the argument about American living standards and make that a viable campaign argument. You know, often when it's raised, Republicans say class warfare. And suddenly the people say, oh, well, we can't have that. Well, in effect, there has been a kind of class warfare going on. The overclass has been reaping the benefits that formerly under went to the middle class. And I think Senator Obama gets at this when he says we need to rebalance the economy. We need to make the economy work for the many and not just for the few.
Richard, is the economy the number one issue for voters? You've been out on the campaign trail.
Yes, I have, and there has been a pretty dramatic turnaround in voters' priorities over the course of the last year and this long campaign, where Iraq was clearly at the top of the field in the list of voters' priorities, and now it's clearly the economy. And what you have are the Democrats at least saying, trying to tie the two things together, saying obviously they have their own economic messaging, but saying as the war continues, the country cannot afford to be wasting money in Iraq when it needs to spend the money at home. And on the other side, you've got John McCain saying, in spite of what he said previously, that he doesn't really know much about the economy, that he does have an economic plan and does have new policies on the mortgage crisis. So the economy is front and center. I expect it will be. There's clearly going to be a stark choice between the Democrats and Republicans when it comes to Iraq, and that's going to be an important debate. But the economy is just going to keep coming back time and time again because no matter what the technical definition of a recession is, I think the recovery is likely to be slow. Investors are very risk-averse right now. Anytime the financial system suffers banking collapses, the kind of level of crisis we've seen recently, it has a chilling effect throughout the economy. So this is going to be a very important thing, not just for the policy positions, but whether the candidates can voice the concerns of voters and figure out a way out that voters can believe in.
Carl is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, I have a comment and a question. The comment is about the legacy of this administration. It's one of war, bad economics, lies, tromping on civil liberties of Americans. And my question, and I'm very serious about this, how in God's name was this man elected twice? And you all have a good day.
Well, that's a pretty big question.
Well, usually the obvious answer is he got more votes, but of course we know that's not the case.
That's the first time. That's
right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's talk more about the campaign. Robert is on the line with us from Charlestown, Rhode Island. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hello. This morning, the DNC released their talking points on McCain. Did you see that?
I haven't seen him yet. Have any of our guests?
No.
Why don't you fill us in, Robert?
Okay, well, essentially they want to run against McCain's immigration policy. They're going to run on a right wing, the immigrants are the reason why the economy is failing. So I don't see the purpose of that. And there's nothing about running against the neocon foreign policy. There's nothing about running against free trade versus fair trade. So if they don't differentiate from the Republicans and only basically say that they have different opinions on the things that the Republicans are running on, can they win the White House?
Steve Chapman, why don't we take that from a pure question point of view, since none of us have seen the White House, or rather the DNC talking points yet. How can the Democrats win the White House?
Well, I guess the real question is, how could they lose it this year? I mean, you're 5 years into an unpopular war with no end in sight. The economy is going into a recession from all appearances. And even if it doesn't go into a recession, there's a lot of turmoil that has people worried. The fact that McCain is still fairly close in the polls has got to give Democrats a lot of concern. What they're going to run on, obviously, they're going to run on the economy. I do think – I don't think they're going to use immigration. I don't think they're going to try to run to the right of McCain on immigration. Both Obama and Clinton have basically been in agreement with McCain's original bill on immigration. I think they will run against trade agreements. They will run against the White House's entire economic policy.
Jack Beatty, if the battle between Senators Obama and Clinton goes all the way to the convention late this summer, early this fall, will the Democrats have enough time to run out a winning strategy if John McCain is not stumbling between now and then?
Well, that's the great fear. We had a couple of weeks ago, we had the leading economic modeler of elections, Ray Fair, on. And Ray at Yale says this election's over. All his projections say this is going to be a 55% Democratic win just given the economy. And he says this is the major issue. Well, the other model, of course, is the model of the damage that nomination fighting does to presidential candidates. And the longer the primary process, the tougher it is for the general election for the ultimate nominee, and the worst scenario for nominees has been a convention fight and then a vice president who doesn't heal, a vice presidential nominee who doesn't heal the party's wounds. Well, if it goes to the convention and if Hillary and there is a fight there over seating Michigan and Florida delegates and Hillary Clinton is not nominated as the vice president, that's a bad scenario. Under that scenario, since 1964, the parties that have had that have lost by landslides.
There's new data out just now backing you up on that, Jack Beatty. Times' Michael Duffy reports in a new Time poll of registered Democrats in Pennsylvania, and I'm reading here, backed by more than half of all white Democrats, Hillary Clinton, white female Democrats, Hillary Clinton holds a 6-point lead over Obama in PA, a new statewide poll by Time reveals, when leaners, voters who've not firmly decided who to vote for but are leaning one way or the other are added in, Clinton's 6-point lead grows to 8 points. But there also seems to be a measure of deep anti-Obama sentiment in Clinton's Keystone State coalition. Roughly a quarter of Clinton voters, 26%, say they'd be more likely to vote for John McCain in the general election if Obama is the eventual Democratic nominee. Spelling trouble for Obama, Jack, if he's the nominee?
Yes, that is worrisome. And I'm wondering, Richard, if you've seen much of that out on the campaign trail, this resistance to Obama possibly because of for reasons of race?
There are mixed reasons. Most of all, I think the driving force is just the intensity of the battle and the desire, understandably, if you're committed to one candidate or another, to win. And defeat is very hard to deal with. I had an interesting conversation with Howard Dean the other day, and not because Howard Dean, as head of the DNC, is going to really broker a peace between these two candidates, but because his experience in 2004 was actually quite similar. His supporters were intensely passionate about his candidacy, and even more passionate about hating John Kerry. He epitomized everything they loathed about the party, about politics in general. And Howard Dean told me it took him a good 3 months, not just to get over the sort of grieving process for him and his supporters, but to convince them that, given a choice, John Kerry was better for them than George W. Bush. And he said, quite rightly, that given enough time, they came around. And the question here is, do Democrats have enough time to patch things up and realize what the choices are? I promise you, in March or April of 2004, when Dean finally bowed out and Kerry finally clinched the nomination, there were many Deaniacs who said they would rather move to Canada than vote for John Kerry. And it just didn't work out that way.
Fred is on the line from Rondo, South Carolina. Hi, Fred.
Hey, Bob. Greetings. I wanted to mention during the campaign, it seems that the press has been real reluctant to examine Senator McCain's record as a POW. For instance, he signed a statement denouncing the United States and the Vietnam War, and nobody wants to mention that. It was a tremendous boost for the North Vietnamese at the time, but people feel, you know, they keep mentioning that he's this great hero, but I think they should also mention some of the negative things he did when they told him he could leave, and he said, well, he's going to stay to help be with his buddies, but he could have helped rescue the POWs if he came out and gave information about where they were, for instance. Nobody seems to be examining that part of his record, which seems to be a main part of his campaign.
Steve Chapman, seems hard to believe that John McCain will face serious and tough questions about his Vietnam service, considering the fact he spent all those years as a prisoner of war.
And a lot of those years came when he could have been released, and he said he wasn't going to leave until the people who had been captured before him were released. I think it's pretty hard to portray his time in captivity as anything but heroic, the way he handled it. He has written about signing that statement. He said he was deeply ashamed, but everybody has their breaking point, and they kept on McCain. It took longer for him than for most people, I think. I think, obviously, I don't think the Democrats are going to try and run on the subject of McCain's war record. They're going to try and run on a position that if you're electing John McCain, you're really electing George W. Bush for a third term.
Well, given what you say, how surprised are you right now that the president's approval ratings are in the 20s, but John McCain's remains at somewhere within the vicinity of 48 points, still pretty high?
Well, I think it's because he's always had this reputation as something of a maverick, as not being beholden to the sort of old guard in the Republican Party, and having the ability to work across party lines and so on. And he's got I think the Republicans are going to have already sort of closed ranks behind him. There was some doubt about that after he became the presumptive nominee, at the Conservative Political Action Conference and so on. But the question is, the independent voters, the people who sometimes vote Democratic and sometimes vote Republican, and I think they are open to McCain in a way that they would not have been to Mitt Romney, say.
And who best might be a vice presidential candidate for John McCain? Mitt Romney?
I don't think so, for the simple reason that Mitt Romney was not a very popular candidate. I don't think people who are exposed to him like him very well, and I don't think he would help McCain with anybody with conservatives who I think will, you know, when presented with a choice of either a Clinton or Obama, will, you know, go to the polls and vote for McCain.
Richard Wolff?
You know, vice presidential picks are made at a particular point in time, depending on what the debate is at that moment, what the candidate needs for a brief lift moving into their convention. I suspect, running through the summer, that John McCain's age will actually be the most important factor that he faces, as well as Iraq, but specifically age. And so I think whoever he chooses is going to be young and have some vitality to him.
Jack Beatty, we have time for a name, and that's it.
How young is Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota? I don't know.
Jack Beatty, Richard Wolff, Steve Chapman, thank you very much. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.